is State versus Bean. Justice Frydenberg is recused from this matter and also from the second case of the day. Mr. LaFleur, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. And may it please the court, I'm Jack LaFleur. I represent the appellant in this matter, Jordan Bean. I would ask to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal in this case. I'm going to ask you today to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Bean's motion for post-conviction relief, which was following an evidentiary hearing that was held in the District Court of Madison County. In this case, Mr. Bean raised different issues with relationship to his trial counsel and his direct appellate counsel. And Mr. Bean was represented by three sets of trial counsel at the trial court level before he entered no contest pleas when a plea agreement was reached at the trial court level.
I want to ask you a question about that. You have two instances of the public defender's office representing your client, right?
That's correct.
Now, there's one instance, however, at least, two perhaps, where it wasn't the public defender's office.
That's correct.
Now, as to ineffective assistance of those counsel, there is no reason, is there not, that shouldn't be raised on direct appeal?
Well, that is not what the trial court decided. The trial court, in its opinion on the post-conviction motion, characterized all three sets of counsel as trial counsel, including the second set, the public defender's office, as trial counsel. And so the trial court characterized that those issues were not waived.
Well, that whether or not it's waived is a question of law.
That's correct.
We're not bound by what the trial court decided. But we have consistently required that ineffective assistance of counsel claims be made at the first opportunity. And here where you have the public defender who was appellate counsel, and then you have the public defender who was part of trial counsel, I would grant you we don't expect the public defender to raise ineffective assistance claims as to himself or his colleagues. But as to the other lawyers that were trial counsel, is there any principled basis upon which you would contend that appellate counsel should not be required to raise ineffectiveness claims where it's not himself or his colleagues?
I couldn't, Your Honor, I couldn't find anything that was directly on point where there was an issue of several sets of counsel and then one of them was reappointed or rehired to do the direct appeal. So I don't think that there's anything directly on point there. With respect to case law, the closest two instances that I saw that somewhat relate to this would be a couple more recent cases, State v. Molina, which is a 2010 case, and that's where the public defender's office had the trial counsel level and then started the direct appeal and then withdrew after filing an initial brief and then another attorney was appointed, filed a supplemental brief, and in that instance, the court said that the second attorney on direct appeal that did the supplemental brief should have raised the issues of ineffective assistance of counsel as to the trial counsel. And so that's not directly the same here, because here you have the public defender's office was the second set of trial counsel. And so I think you get into a circumstance of where you ask whether that second set, whether they ratified or acquiesced to the certain decisions of the first trial counsel, which errors are owned by that second set and which were committed by the second set, which were committed by the first set. And so I think that the principle that I think that the trial court characterized as if they were trial counsel during the trial court level at the pendency of the trial court stage, than their trial court counsel, and they don't have to raise the issues of ineffective assistance. Nevertheless, Mr. Bean raised ineffective of appellate counsel for failing to raise the issue, just so we can get these issues of his ineffective assistance of counsel at trial counsel decided on the merits. So I think that, as you indicated, it's decided as a matter of law. I think that we've preserved the issue the issue to be decided on the merits because Mr. Bean also argued that appellate counsel was ineffective by failing to, direct appellate counsel was ineffective by failing to raise those issues of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Was the trial counsel or the trial judge giving your client the benefit of the doubt, covering all its bases? Is that what was happening?
I think that it did, Your Honor. I think that because the trial court reached the merits of the remaining issues of the post-conviction motion. And so the other thing that the trial court said was that it said that the state didn't raise the issue of waiver, that it didn't raise the issue. And as Justice Castle points out, that's decided as a matter of law. And so we continue to try to preserve that issue just so these other instances of what we characterize as ineffective assistance of his trial counsel, all three sets, are preserved.
Thank you for addressing that. You may want to turn to the merits in your remaining time.
Thank you, and I will do so. What we've pointed out on the merits as far as the issues that Mr. Bean brought forward and we've assigned as error, are the ineffective assistance that Mr. Bean received as far as all three sets of his trial counsel on the failure to advise him as to his potential affirmative defenses in this case, the counseling that they gave him on the spousal privilege issue, and then also failure to interview witnesses that were identified in this case, and then the failure to advise Mr. Bean with respect to any type of preserving issues that were raised at the trial court level in motions in limine or pretrial motions, failing to advise him that he wouldn't be able to raise those issues down the road. And so our contention is that by those pieces of counseling that Mr. Bean received, his pleas in this case were as a result of ineffective assistance of counsel, so they were not knowingly and voluntarily entered in that respect, or that it should be voided as a matter of law because of the poor counseling that Mr. Bean received.
Did the trial court make some credibility decisions?
Yes,
here?
They did, Your Honor. And in this case, as I pointed out, in this case, there was no live testimony that was received by the court. And so the court had to judge credibility of the witnesses just based off of the paper record, which is also what you will be, which is also what's before your court.
The trial judge was there for the proceedings as they unfolded originally.
That's correct.
So it's not as if the trial judge doesn't have a leg up on us in looking at what the record shows. Is that correct?
Well, I think that the trial court has essentially the same record that you have in this case
what's our standard of review?
It's for clear error, Your Honor. And so I think that's what the standard of review is in this case. And so our contention is that clear error was made. If you look at the record and you look at the inconsistencies that are there, our contention is that this raises to the level of clear error. I'll reserve the balance of my time, if I may.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. I'll start by addressing the issue of whether or not any of these claims could or should have been raised on direct appeal. To address your question, Justice Castle, I mean, I think there are certain situations where if an attorney is, you have one attorney there for a plea hearing, a new attorney for sentencing hearing, and they come up and they want to allege ineffective assistance against the plea attorney, I think that would be legitimate and permissible because you have, you got a clear break in the representation, and that makes sense to me. This case, to me, is a little bit different. I think it's a little bit messier and potentially complicated here, given that, at least as I understand his claims in his motion, they appear to allege that all of his trial counsel were ineffective, so I think that poses some problem with respect to whether that could have been raised on direct appeal. And then I, at least if I put myself in that attorney's shoes, I would have some concern, given that even if we break this down and say, well, really only one or two of these claims might have pertained to me and other claims pertain solely to other attorneys, you're still alleging that I'm ineffective. And I think that if that claim is in the mix and you're alleging I'm ineffective, I would feel like I need to get out of the case and shouldn't just forge ahead and be alleging other people are ineffective. Yeah,
as you say, it's a little messy. Am I correct on the facts that one of the four is also appellate counsel?
Right. Right, exactly. It's undisputed that appellate counsel was trial counsel for a period of time, a brief period of time, about a month. But he was in the mix, and some of these claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, I think, would encompass, or at least potentially encompass, his performance while he was trial counsel, which...
And what, a colleague as well? Is that right? Or not a colleague?
Of the public defender's office? The colleague of the public defender is who handled the direct appeal, but it was the public defender's office.
Office, nonetheless. Right. So there's another level of complication.
Yes. It seems to me that it's a kind of a unique and messy enough case that I guess we're comfortable with the notion that these claims should not have been raised on direct appeal.
But in any event, then there's an allegation of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
Correct.
So we, if we disagree at least as to some of these matters, we get to it through a layered claim.
Correct.
Okay.
Either way, they're properly before you. We acknowledge and concede that. We are in no way arguing that any of these claims are, procedurally barred. They're properly before you. With that said, I'll move on to the claims. He raises four underlying ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims. I'll briefly address each if time permits here. As far as his first claim regarding the failure to advise on the defenses of self-defense and defense of others, he can't show deficient performance on this claim because each of his trial attorneys testified that they did advise him on these defenses, which the district court found to be more credible than his testimony to the contrary. The finding is not clearly erroneous, so this claim is without merit. As far as his second claim regarding trial counsel's failure to properly advise on the spousal privilege, he can't show deficient performance here because each of his trial attorneys testified that they specifically advised him not to discuss his case with anyone other than them and never gave him any indication that communications with his wife or anyone else would be privileged. The district court again found this testimony to be credible over that of Bean. He's again failed to show it's clearly erroneous, so this claim is without merit. His third claim, that trial counsel failed to interview and depose witnesses, he can't show deficient performance on this claim because the record reflects that his trial attorneys contacted all the witnesses known to them, made efforts to seek out additional witnesses and evidence as well, all of which, of course, turned out to be unhelpful. The district court found this to be credible over that of Bean, so he cannot show deficient performance. We'd submit he also can't show prejudice on this claim because, as noted in our brief, he hasn't alleged or shown what additional information or evidence would have been provided by these other witnesses that were supposedly not contacted. So we would submit that claim fails on the prejudice prong as well. And as far as his fourth and final claim, failure to advise that he couldn't appeal from pretrial rulings, he can't show deficient performance here because his trial attorneys at the time of his pleas, McCarthy and Martin, specifically advised him that he would be waiving that right if he entered his pleas. The district court once again found that testimony to be credible, which is not clearly erroneous. And once again, on the prejudice prong, he hasn't alleged or shown how this would have mattered. He hasn't identified any pretrial ruling or rulings he would have wanted to appeal from, let alone that it would have been successful. So that claim fails on the prejudice prong as well, in our view. We submit that all the underlying claims were properly denied. He was not entitled to post-conviction relief on those claims. So to the extent he raises these as a layered claim, his appellate counsel was not ineffective for failing to raise any of those claims on direct appeal. Dropping stuff all over the place. If there are no further questions, we would ask you to affirm the judgment of the district. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 1 minute and 31 seconds, Mr. LaFleur.
Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to responding to what the appellee has to say in this matter, I would just say with respect to the performance as far as the potential affirmative defenses, it's clear all three sets of trial counsel, I think, which is important in this case, agree that Mr. Bean was intent on going to trial in this case. And I think that dovetails into the second He was intent on going to trial the entire time that this case was pending, and all sets of counsel agree on that. With respect to the spousal privilege issue, the third set of trial counsel essentially says that Mr. Bean's case was so damaged based on the tampering with witness charge that arose out of communications with his spouse, that he felt like Mr. Bean needed, he heavily recommended that Mr. Bean take a plea in this case. And so I think that that just goes, that dovetails together as far as the deficient performance, insofar as it shows that the advice on spousal privilege injured his case because he was intent on going to trial the entire time. With respect to the state, with the procedural bar issue, I would just say the state says that it's, that its contention is that this is not procedurally barred. I think that a good rule for this, for this case is that trial counsel is trial counsel no matter how brief. I would ask this court to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Bean's post-conviction relief and remand accordingly. Thank you.
Before you sit down, didn't your client get a hearing in regard to the insufficiency of appellate counsel? Didn't your client get a hearing on all of those issues?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
So is there any prejudice problem here?
I don't believe so, so long as if you do find that that appellate counsel should have brought this forward, if you then go to the merits of the underlying claims, the layered claim of his trial counsel's deficient performance. And I think as long as you analyze and look at those issues, then I don't think that there's prejudice with respect to appellate counsel's performance because of reaching those issues.
Thank you.
Thank
Were you.
You
appointed in this matter, Mr. LaFleur?
I was, Your Honor.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
The next case of the day, then, is McPherson versus City of Scottsbluff.